McGeezy Will Fly, A Grandmother's Journey to Stop Line 3, Part 2, by Barbara Rhine. Back at the welcome camp, a few grandmothers stripped to dip in the Mississippi's headwaters down that path from the road. Now, normally that would be my MO, at least when I was just a few years younger. But right now I am so tired that all I can do is lie on a bench and swat mosquitoes, a hopeless task. Next comes another long meeting at the welcome camp with inconclusive results for the next morning's plans, but then again, also with another delicious buffet supper. Back at Big Sandy Lodge, I embark through a twilight without mosquitoes. Do they use DDT or what? On a walking tour of our far apart grandmother suites and enjoy the synchronicity between a little vodka and some unstructured human company. All this culminates in an invitation from Don, another Lakota YG, to go with them and the OGs and the rest of our coordinating committee to a different camp the following day. So we set off at 8 a.m. the next morning on the familiar long drive, again through fabulously beautiful countryside, to arrive at a place where leaves of fresh green and bright yellow swish and sparkle in the early morning sun. The camp is called McGeezy in Ojibwe, the eagle in English. Substantial tents promise orderly interiors and true protection from the ever-changing elements. The first night had plunged into the 40s, lashed with hard rain. The second day was cold. The third had been in the 80s, and now the fourth day presents with a benign and gentle morning breeze. Here's how McGeezy residents had prepared for the visit, taken from a Facebook post written by Tasha, McGeezy's camp leader. "The grandmothers are coming," we told one another as we rushed through camp. All morning, my sister Ember had spent chopping mushrooms and onions. Others prepared potatoes for hash browns. Our chickens had given us 3 new eggs for the scramble. The water bubbled at the fire, ready to become coffee and swamp tea. We all ran about gathering gifts for the grandmothers, sage, tea, sweetgrass, coffee, to welcome them home. By the gate, a young man and his father prepared our humble driveway for the vehicles that would carry our grandmothers safely here, laying out a rug and raking the dirt. We braided our hair, put on our ribbon skirts and shirts, smudged down and gave thanks for such a beautiful day. Our drum carriers warmed their drums at the fire, preparing their hides for the songs and the ceremony. A young man greets me with a square of cloth that reads, "McGeezy Will Fly," stamped with a black eagle whose wings hang down to spell stop on the left side and line on the right. The three in red is on the bird's body. He fastens it to the back of my shirt with safety pins, and we lucky grandmothers settle into another circle of comfy camp chairs. Tasha, surrounded by her three daughters and one toddler son who plays at her feet, receives her Lakota grandmothers with a formal welcome, followed by a painful account of a particular historic conflict between the Fond du Lac, her own tribe, and the Dakota, closely related by language to the Lakota. Her face bathed in tears, she concludes after a description so chilling, she must have meant for it to be private between herself and the OGs and YGs, that a serious debt is owed from the Fond du Lac to the Dakota. And so she intends to repay it by gifting the land where we are, a small private parcel, infinitesimal, compared to what each tribe had before the white settlers arrived, to the Dakota Nation when a warrior visits next week. By now, some of the camp residents have joined us to eat, including Phoenix, a Native woman whose beautiful clothes highlight the solemnity of her downturned mouth. Another young man asks if I want honey or maple syrup on my pancake. Delicious food is served. With more tears and lots of laughter, Tasha moves on to describe her own childhood, scarred by adults with addictions and men who, quote, took what they wanted sexually. Once, she tells us, she was invited to a, quote, officer's training. By whom or for what was not clear to me. But when she got there, they told her it involved alcohol, enough to get her fully drunk. She doesn't drink, she assures us, but that day she made an exception. They asked how much she weighed, and at that time, the answer was 210 pounds. Now Tayshia is nowhere near that big. They calculated this meant she had to have 11 drinks, after which, she tells us gleefully, she sexually harassed every man in the room, the details of which she was too drunk to remember, except for one guy shouting out to her that she'd messed with his dick. I find this tale puzzling, disturbing. But whatever has or hasn't happened to Tayshia, she's no one's fool now. She knows the men who work on the pipeline because the Fond du Lac tribal leadership has a deal with Enbridge, which promises jobs in exchange for support of the project. Tayshia remains in fierce opposition to Line 3. She intends no help at all for those who take the Enbridge jobs, but she does admit that she enjoys the way the workers welcome her arrival at the pipeline, because the resulting brouhaha will stall the work and then they'll get overtime. She understands that this does not mean they're ready to walk off the job. Still, she hopes that might happen someday. Done eating, Tayshia contemplates her plate and informs us it's compostable, which she had thought meant that she could throw it away. No, she had been corrected. Compost. You let it become part of the earth. You use it for the future crops. She's amused by her own ignorance, proud of her camp's determination to run off renewable energy alone. I get up to wander around. I pee on the ground behind the bushes as instructed by a sign on the wall of the toilet structure. Put back together just in time, I murmur hello to a young person passing by who would have been called a transvestite in my time, with her strawberry-printed dress, her elaborate makeup, and long lashes. When I get back to the circle, the two-spirit young man with painted nails and colorful clothes, with four names, including two that sound Jewish, has taken center stage. He tells us that he reveres ritual in each word, each hand gesture, even the shake of his head. His life story is another one of sorrow. His parents raised him in Southern California, where they had left their indigenous culture behind and substituted alcohol and drugs. He found his people's res as a teenager, but was rejected there due to his two-spirit nature. So he will do his ritual observance here in Megizi, his true home, he assures us, tears interspersed with tender smiles. Then he sings and plays his guitar sweetly and with skill. Children run everywhere while Tayshia's blonde toddler stays right at her feet. His father, the only other blonde in sight, is a spare young man who has helped with the cooking and cleaning before our eyes and has also told us he's been arrested for sitting atop a pipeline. Eventually, that dad, whom Tayshia has named as her partner, hustles the older girls off to remote learning, and all too soon it's time to get back to Big Sandy for the noon meeting. The Lakota grandmothers, dignified throughout, say their formal goodbyes, and we invite the Megizi community to join us at Big Sandy later that evening for our ritual to mark the year's anniversary of George Floyd's murder. Tayshia summed it up on Facebook. The grandmothers arrived in two vehicles, many of them Lakota from Cheyenne River and Pine Ridge, brought by our allies, 1,000 grandmothers. We sat around the fire sharing in food, laughter, love, and medicine, gifting our stories and support for one another. We shed tears at the arrival and the departure of the grandmothers who had traveled so far to voice their support of us, our camp, and our cause. We made relations and are moving forward with the hope to strengthen them. With the strength, prayers, and blessings of the Lakota people, we feel renewed in our oath to protect the sacred and stop Line 3.